the 3rd, 2019, and we are in New Ulm, and happy to be here. It is always good to get out into the communities that we serve. The first matter on the calendar for oral argument is the case of Jacqueline Jones versus Robert Jones. It appears that the parties are seated at council table, which is not something that our Court of Appeals rules permit. I'm going to ask if you just take a seat in the gallery, because you both have lawyers representing you. Sure. You got your badge to put back in. Okay. While we're getting settled here, I'm going to remind council that you each have 15 minutes to do your oral argument. Council for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Due to the Court of Appeals error, we do not have a timer like we usually bring along, but the time will be indicated by the clerk. She will hold up cards that tell you when you have 5 minutes left, when you have 1 minute left, and when it is time to stop. So please be mindful of that. I will kind of watch the clock as well, and we'll make sure that you have your time, but that you leave plenty of time for the other party. Finally, it's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument, because we are recording these proceedings. And as soon as we get our judge back, we will begin with counsel for appellant. You may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel, I am Attorney Jacob Bertholz, representing Robert Jones, the petitioner and respondent in the underlying case and appellant in this matter. The essential legal issue for this court to decide, and it is a legal issue, is whether or not the district court judge, Todd Westfall, made the correct legal determination of whether the endangerment standard applied to Mr. Jones's motion, or whether the court should consider the best interest factors. That is the Bell's position, that given the change in the law and ongoing cases, that in this case, there should have been a best interest analysis. There was no best interest analysis, and the case must be reversed and remanded for a best interest analysis. I'll start with some of the basic.
Can I ask you for sort of a preliminary standard of review kind of question? You know, I understand your position is that your client was not seeking to modify physical custody and was not trying to modify a parenting plan, so that the governing statute here would be 518.175. That's your argument, correct?
Yes.
And then within that, my question is this. Is the determination whether a requested change in parenting time would effectively change a child's primary residence, is that a question of fact or a question of law? Or is it a mixed question of fact and law?
Well, I think it depends on how it's applied by the district court. I think the way the court applied it and made its analysis here, but if it's a more esoteric question.
Yeah, I understand your argument that the court applied the wrong standard here, and I may agree with you on that. We'll talk about that this morning. But if we assume that 518.175 subdivision 5 is the applicable statute, and the question initially is whether the requested change would change primary residence, is that a fact or law question for a court?
Depending on how it's being interpreted, probably not a question of law, and it really just depends on the parenting schedule that's issued, and that's probably under the abuse of discretion standard, and whether the findings clearly are supported by the record. I think if this really dives into the real challenge that the Court of Appeals, I think, has struggled with is when they're with the change in the law being it's not a restriction on parenting time, going all the way back to the Archer and Anderson cases of whether or not 10-15% changes in parenting time are restricted. The legislature changed that rule in the statute, says it's not a restriction. And now district court judges continuously struggle with the concept of whether or not we're restricting a parent's parenting time after parties come. We continue to struggle with this, it appears, in the district courts, where they stipulate to something less than 50-50, a party comes back for 50-50, and now what are we doing? Another more interesting question I struggle with the district courts is whether or not you have to prove a substantial change to even make that argument. And the answer, I think, is no. Based on the statute and the case law, to get to 50-50 under the statute, you don't even need a substantial change. You just have to present that the best interest factors support your request. And so, but district courts struggle with that concept. And in this case, the district court is so far down that road that it applied the endangerment standard. So I don't even think we get to that. It has to be just reversed and remanded for the court to even allow this court to have an appropriate appellate review of whether or not the best interest factors apply in this case at all. And the court simply refused. And interestingly enough, the MJH or the Healy case came down after I filed the appeal. I dismissed it. Begged the judge to make the appropriate findings before I got here, and again, he refused, it, just to allow appropriate appellate review.
So it's your position that if the court applied the wrong standard and the best interest standard should have applied, we'd need to remand it back to the district court?
Yes.
Even if the court considered factors relevant to the best interest in its decision?
Right, because it said it wasn't. I love Judge Westfall because he likes to write prolific memorandums and opine in footnotes to allow the court to, is he or is he not considering it? I don't think he was, nor did he intend. I think he just was trying to tell me why I was wrong. But I don't think he was actually assessing, because he doesn't make an analysis of the two parties' positions. He doesn't make any analysis of the children or the consideration of the arguments to the children or the impact of the children.
But if... and I'm not saying I agree or disagree, the question of change in primary residence, the question of what a child's primary residence is, I mean, part of it is a designation, and here the designation was mother's house. And the question about whether going to a 50-50 parenting time split during the school year would change that was more than a math problem. It also had to do with, you know, where is the school located, and is there a homework central, that kind of thing. And I mean... I think it's fair to say the district court did consider more than just the time. I mean, the court looked at the fact that the parties must have intended that there be a particular place where during this, you know, where they sleep during the school year and where presumably they do homework and that kind of stuff. So the court did sort of consider a totality of the circumstances, didn't it? Even if it didn't expressly say it was doing so?
No.
Why not?
Because the court just continued to reaffirm its own conclusions. It simply said, well, I'm right because the parties must have assumed. Well, there's nothing to support the court's findings, and even the findings it attempted to find. It simply didn't go back to the record and have nothing to base those things to be true. The parties, if the court even looks at every single affidavit, and I'm happy to recite the record on the affidavits. And what I think is the most important piece here is that the court simply bolstered its own conclusion that the endangerment standard applied by citing facts in the record to support that conclusion. It didn't make any effort to find that it's best for the children. It just simply followed findings to support its legal conclusion. So I think it would be an error, both in interpreting the court's decision and in general, to make a conclusion that we want to affirm the district court's failed attempt and refused attempt to look at the best interest factors and say, well, implicitly it looked at the best interest factors when it explicitly says it was not.
Well, in terms of the best interest factors, what other pieces of evidence should the court have considered, or would the court have considered, in your view, if it was doing a best interest analysis?
Right. Well, some of it is just to highlight, I think, all the factors, and it just didn't. But I think some of the key critical factors ties into the motion that I also brought up on error on appeal. We have now a 16 and almost 15-year-old, and no discussion by the district court as my client. Even though we don't have statements to the children, I don't think it's disputed that they enjoy spending, for example, lots of time with dad. I mean, the key thing here is that Mr. Jones says, and mother does not deny in the affidavits, that my client's position, which is that the children have a wonderful time in the summer and like spending time with him and would like to spend more time with him and have that 50-50 schedule. The court, I asked for an interview of the children. The court denied that interview. The parties could have submitted statements. That's an ongoing hot topic with district courts. And
isn't that really irrelevant if, depending on which standard you apply? I mean, if it's an endangerment standard, it doesn't make any difference whether you interview the children or not.
That's correct. I completely agree. The court wouldn't have error if it simply said, There's no endangerment. I'll be stipulated to this report. There's no, both parents are such good parents, and I think that's why the court should start by looking at stipulation, not looking at the conclusion and then justifying the conclusion. I mean, result-oriented jurisprudence is, I think, what Judge Westfall wanted to do.
Well, the stipulation recognizes that the children enjoy good relationships with both parents, which I credit the parents for, and the fact that the children see father every day, even if they don't stay overnight. But the parties also agreed that during the school year was important for whatever reason to be at one home every night. And, I mean, isn't that a factor that the court legitimately considered in terms of deciding primary residence, I guess?
Yes, and I think if the court would go back to the time and look back at the lawyers and say, did anyone understand what primary residence meant in 2016? I think if we're really to look at it, and I wasn't underlying counsel, Kennedy and Mr. Colmeyer, who I both appreciate, that, and also, which is in the record, that Mr. Jones is facing a sort of protection and was waived a dismissal and said, go ahead, just take this, give me some primary residence, which is very unique. He received both joint legal and joint physical in that context. And I would suggest the court looks at the actual stipulated language. The parties look beyond, and I'm looking at paragraph 5 of Collins Addendum, page 13. Paragraph 5 in the conclusions of law goes to the issue of primary residence. Most counsel and stipulations of court reviews probably just simply says it's primary residence. This does not. This, in fact, goes on far beyond that, which says the parties, contrary to what I believe Judge Westfall implied, is that mother's home is designated as the child's legal residence for purposes of school registration and other purposes. And a simple example of this is what's happened recently. I know it's not in the record, but the children, my client lives in the country a couple miles, and kids wanted farm permits. They can't get them because mom's residence is the primary residence. That's the kind of...
But again, that language tied the decision of the parties that designate mother's home as the primary residence to the question, to the issue of school. And I mean, isn't that a valid consideration in determining primary residence? Where is the school located? Where is there the expressed desire to have the kids be when they have to do things like do homework at night and get up in the morning and get on the bus or whatever they need to get to school?
Absolutely agree. And as often I say, the primary residence becomes a battle of the metro and people that live far away. I mean, if I can go between two school districts and I'm 1 mile away between Minnetonka and, you know, Shoreview or somewhere, I guess that's too far, but I'm the next neighboring school district, as my friends are, that is a big deal, especially when they have sports and big money and big issues. But distance becomes a much more element. The parties are, I believe, they're 4 miles apart and in the same school district. So if you had changed schools and very even closer to Mr. Jones at this point.
There's a question at the respondent's address was your primary residence of the children. Is that accurate in the stipulation, in the dissolution?
The mother has a primary residence?
Yeah. So the thing I'm struggling with is the judge has to make a determination at some point as to whether that changes that in terms of time. So isn't that discretionary, or what's your best argument that that is not discretionary in the for the district court?
I would put it as a combination of the appropriate appellate review, is that there isn't findings to make a decision.
That decision. That there's not what?
There's not sufficient findings on that, because it's tied to the best interest. The NJH in the Supreme Court says repeatedly, which is why I brought a motion for amended findings, that it's a larger question. And yes, the court made a memorandum based on that, which basically says why I made the appropriate review. And I think it all goes back to one thing that we haven't talked about, which I think is probably the most important piece. The court simply just says, well, it changes overnights. Repeatedly makes the end-run-around argument that primary residence means overnights, which was essentially refuted by the Supreme Court, and says, no, you can't do overnights. And I said that to Judge Russell.
Well, I don't know the Supreme Court. I mean, I think time is part of it, mm-hmm. But it's not all of it. I agree with you with that. That
yes.
There's more to defining custody and primary residence than a math problem.
And one of this case is very factually unique, and why most people would say, most attorneys would say, we'd never agree to the stipulation, which is essentially an exchange once or twice a day, every day. I mean, that's very unique. And I think to look back at this in the appropriate context is simply to say the parties wanted joint daily control and access to the children every single day. And that's a fact, almost 3 hours both ways. If the court would just simply say, when do the kids go to bed, 6 to 9, my client gets 3 to 6, or 5:30, depending on when the drop-off is. They see each other equal waking hours every single day. And of course, we can get into the overnight and the child support. There's no child support. Interestingly enough, this mother makes substantially more income or never asks for child support. The parties didn't at the time. So the parties focused on the children, commendably, and focused on them both having access every day. And the fact that mom wanted to have the kids sleep at home base, as we often refer to as counsel, and have one, is laudable and shouldn't prevent Mr. Jones from ever asking for another overnight. That's essentially the long-term conclusion of what I'm concerned about in this case.
Well, that's not exactly accurate. He was asking for 50-50. That would have been a dramatic change in the overnights during the school year.
I can't dispute it changes the overnights during the school year.
Well, dramatically.
It's certainly more than minimal, right? He doesn't have any, he has to get a lot. Yeah. So that's not in dispute, but he certainly has that every day. And the summer works wonderfully. I think another point to look at this is to tie the summer schedule, and the court just simply ignored the fact that parties week on, week off, overnights, works wonderfully back and forth. I don't think there's any dispute to that. And so where there's this...
But during the school year, the proposed change would modify their daily routine.
Only related to them.
Well, from 5:30 on, that's more than hitting the pillow, right?
Well, I think every time a parent asks for any time, they're changing their routine to some extent. And remember, 15 to 16-year-olds, I think if we changed an infant schedule, we'd probably be having a different argument. It isn't a big deal when the kids have been, unfortunately, for Mr. Jones, been having lots of activities, and he's getting very difficult periods of parenting time. And he's really being prevented. That's the ultimate issue. So my alternate motion in here is even to have Wednesday overnights, and the judge said no. And so Mr. Jones essentially will watch his children. He'll never have a weekday overnight until they turn 18.
All right. Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent. We could hear that.
Thank you. I'm Christopher Kennedy. I'm appearing here on behalf of Jacqueline Jones, the petitioner in the original action and the respondent in the appeal of this particular matter. I think in this particular case, I think it's clear that Judge Westfall took a concerted effort and to try to determine what the issues were in this particular matter and to determine what the appropriate legal remedy and legal standard should be in this particular matter. I don't agree with Mr. Burkholz and his conclusions that Judge Westfall came to a conclusion and was only looking to put together memorandums to support what his conclusions previously were. I think if you look at the court's order in this particular matter, he was very well aware of the standard of review, very well aware of what was happening in the MJH case, and considered strongly the applications that would have in this particular case. And I think he used the right standard. The right standard has to be the engagement standard. It has to be what we're taking a look at because there was going to be a complete change of circumstance.
Well, okay, my problem is that MJH was a situation where the mother had sole physical custody.
Yeah.
Here there has always been joint physical custody. I think that is a distinction that makes a real difference. I'm really struggling with the district court's application of 518, 18 and the endangerment status when there is not going to be how do we get to the question of de facto custody change when it's already joint custody?
I think you have to take a look at the entire stipulation that was put together by the parties. And we're not talking about a trial where the parties were contesting the matter and the court made a determination based on what they saw at trial. We saw two individuals that were represented by counsel that came to a concerted effort to what they agreed to, what their stipulation, what their agreement was going to be on parenting time. In this particular case, they did. They agreed to these to have joint legal and joint physical custody, but they were also very clear that Mrs. Jones is home, is going to be the primary residence for the guardians of the party's children. And that has to be it.
Well, and okay, let's move to the question then of primary residence. On this record, Why was father's request for additional parenting time akin to a change in the child's primary?
Because it dramatically changed the ability of Ms. Jones to have her relationship with the children. And that's where the court was really taking a look at this matter. It's not a matter of how they're going to benefit or how they're going to change Mr. Jones's ability to see the kids.
Well, how does it change the children's primary residence? That's, to me, a different question than either parent's interests. How did it change? How would going to an alternate week parenting time schedule change the children's primary residence?
Because right now the kids are sitting during the school year, staying with mom, having their homework, having their evening plans, all with mom. This would be looking to change on every other week type of schedule. So their normal routine would be disturbed, and it would dramatically affect how the kids are going to be able to participate in activities. They have to coordinate with both parents rather than just coordinating with mom. Or in this particular case, if it's an after-school activity, coordinating with that. But the thing, when the parties were agreeing to the time for Mr. Jones to have after school, the main purpose of that is that here's a period of time where mom's not going to be available because she's going to be at work. We have a choice of sending the kids to after-school activities, which the kids are participating in, or we have a chance of taking the kids to daycare, or dad, because of his work situation, provide that care for the kids. It was an opportunity that the parties saw, and an opportunity that the parties agreed to be best for the kids, that that be provided by the father. But that shouldn't diminish, the role that Ms. Jones had to be in the primary parent during the school year, and particularly on the school evenings.
They're having daycare at their age?
Not at their age, no. Back when it was originally ordered.
Was that in 2016?
Back in 2016, there would have been, daycare was probably a poor person. So probably wouldn't be daycare, but you're obviously going to be concerned about who's going to be seeing the kids after school, who's going to be watching the kids after school, are the kids going to be left alone after school, and whether or not that's a better alternative, or having father provide that extra time be a better alternative for the kids.
Does the desire of the children make a difference here at 15 and 16?
I think originally the desire of the kids would make a difference. I don't think it, for Judge Wassel in making his determination, this matter got to that point. Because he's right. I mean, if the legal standard is that this is an endangerment standard, the primary concern can't be whether the kids want to have something changed or don't have something changed. So he never got to the point, as he pointed out in his memo, because it just wasn't the legal standard that should be applied in this particular case, because we are looking at a de facto change of custody.
Even though there's joint custody?
Even though it was labeled joint custody. But each of the terms has to have a distinct meaning. If there's a purpose for the parties coming in there and say mom's home is going to be the primary residence, and there has to be weight that's given to that, then we're not talking about a situation where somebody gets to come back into court and say that I didn't understand what the agreement was because I didn't have an attorney. Both of them had very competent counsel, and they came up with an agreement. As Mr. Burkholz pointed out, it's an unusual agreement, and that maybe other attorneys may not have done, but there has to be purpose for that, there has to be reason for that. He knew what he was getting into.
If we disagree with your argument that the endangerment standard is the controlling standard to make the requested change here, is there a basis for us still to affirm the district court?
I think so.
And explain that.
But basically, I think that you can, even if you show it's not the endangerment statute, the court took a look at all the factors that were happening in this particular circumstance, and Judge Wassel determined that there wasn't a need for there to be a change in what the court's previous words said. But there had been showing that there's going to be a major benefit to the children, or that there's going to be anything that justifies is going from a week-on-week-off schedule that's going to disrupt what would normally happen with your school year and their normal practice.
Is the question whether a requested change would be a change in the child's primary resident one of fact or law?
Fact. I think it has to be one of fact, because I think you have to take a look at the circumstances that are happening with both parties. You have to take a look at what's happening with the kids. And I think that if we're looking at whether or not there's been a de facto change of custody, or there's going to be a de facto change of custody, it is going to be fact dependent.
Under the father's proposal, where would the primary residence be? Where would the children's primary residence be, and why?
I think under the father's proposal, there would not be a primary residence for the kids. And if you're doing an equal time where it's 50-50 with both of them, I don't know that you can make that determination.
So that amounts to a change in primary residence?
That amounts to a change in primary residence because it goes from being the mother's primary residence to being a joint primary residence for the two of them. And quite frankly, it poses an interesting question if the parties were to live in different school districts. It does not apply in this particular case. But we're not, we're grabbing a standard where, you know, that we're changing those labels without having that endangerment or higher standard. It becomes difficult. And we're at that time of year where there's numerous district courts that are facing that issue where there has been temporary orders, but parties are divorcing other district districts and putting kids into different school districts and having to fight over those issues. I think that's why it's appropriate to have a higher standard.
Well, if, how would the primary residence change as far as the designation as their legal address for school registration? That wouldn't change, would it?
In this case, it would not change, no.
So it really isn't the only change the amount of time that each party spends with the child?
That's the major change that would occur in this particular, yes.
So if primary so how is it not the standard of the best interest of the children when you're talking about the amount of time and that they spend with a child? Why should we care about endangerment in that situation where you have joint custody? I mean, it seems like endangerment would be a situation where there's going to be something bad happening to the children if you change it. But here you're really just talking about the parenting time.
Because from a legal standard, there's a benefit of having finality in the court orders and having a higher standard where we're coming back and taking a look at things. And having that higher standard where the parties have previously agreed to what the primary custody or the primary residence is going to be, and making it harder to challenge that gives...
But the only thing about the primary residence here was where it was designated as their legal address for mailing purposes.
I think the parenting time, when we get into that, shows that the primary residence was more than that. And the idea is during the school year that they're going to be primarily with the mother, and she was going to have pretty much all the time that we'd expect that most parents who are working are going to have with the children. He was given some additional time because his schedule allowed him to have time that most parents that are working would not have. And that was basically, I don't want to say a freebie, but it was a benefit that was able to be provided to him and the children that they would not be evident in most cases.
Why couldn't the district court work out what it thinks is in the best interest of the children under a standard of that doesn't involve endangerment here?
I think the court could take a look at doing that, but I don't think it's appropriate in this particular case because if we're looking at, once the court makes the determination that this is a change of custody, we do have that higher standard that you have to take a look at. You know, I think the question comes really as to whether or not there's a change of custody. You know, we have the standard of review once we have that change of custody. And then we can get into the question whether or not additional parenting time or is it appropriate or not appropriate.
Just for hypothetical purposes, if one of the parties had changed their employment, wouldn't it be wise to change the custodial arrangement to make that work a little better?
I think if one of the parties changed their employment, we'd be probably looking at changing parenting time. I don't know that we'd be looking at changing the number of overnights where the children actually would be residing and getting, you know, doing their homework and going to bed every night. If I think it's a completely different question if one of the parties would get a job that would be significantly out there. You know, if Ms. Jones got a job that allowed her to come home earlier in the evenings, I think that's a bit, you know, and she wanted to take care of the kids or wanted to do something at those times, I think that's a fact question that could be presented to the judge as a modification of parenting time. If Mr. Jones's situation became that he was no longer available for kids, I think the same circumstances would come. I don't believe that it's the number of overnights who doesn't get to the actual custodial situation with their kids. It's just a matter of who's available after work. Anything else, you know, I think will be respectfully be speculation as to whether or not there needs to be more of a modification if somebody's moving out there.
One of the father's alternative requests was to have just a little bit more parenting time during the week. That strikes me as a very different request than the alternating week and something that I don't think would it be even close to a de facto modification of custody. How do we affirm on the district court's denial of even a slight increase in parenting time.
I think the court viewed that, again, as being a de facto change of custody, and all the motions can be kind of the same. Of any of the motions, you know, that's probably the one that's the most difficult to defend. But nonetheless, I don't think, you know, I think there's ability for the court here to not necessarily agree with everything the judge does, but you have to give deference to the district court. And I think in this particular case, what Judge Westfall was taking a look at is the fact that the father is looking at making a change that's going to dramatically affect how the children's day-to-day routine was going to be affected.
Well, how would one day a week, like every Wednesday overnight with father, how would that dramatically change the, you know, the care and custody of these children?
It changes the dynamic between Mr. and Mrs. Jones. And they're obviously a party that aren't getting along as well as, you know, you would hope. That they're working together in marvelous ways, you know, obviously kind of working with the kids. But having that stability and having that every evening where the kids are going to be doing the same thing, I think that's where the judge thought was being appropriate. And when the judge was looking at this particular order and saying that, you know, Mr. Jones has already seen the kids every single day after school, I think he took that as being a portion of the idea that, you know, it's not a situation where the kids are going 2 weeks without seeing dad. They have contact with him the entire time, and there's really no need for them to have that additional overnight and disturb the kids' school. I mean, because even if you're having the additional overnight, well, that's great, having kids going to the parents, and we want to try to provide that. There's no question that there's some disruption to their routine.
Wasn't the judge's order, though, focused on the 50-50 proposal and not the one night a week overnight? I mean, where in the judge's order is there support for your view that this would amount to a de facto change in custody?
I believe when we read the court's order overall, you can see where it's a de facto change in custody. When you're talking about the specific time or the specific incident that we're having, let's say Wednesday overnights, I would agree that Judge Westfall did not necessarily put that in his order. I think you can read that through the intent and the carefulness that he's given to the order overall, but I could not point in his particular order to a specific line where he addressed that issue. I think in his mind it was covered by the fact that we already have, you know, children seeing father after school every day, and that any change is going to be a disruption to the routine.
Thank you.
Perfect timing. Thank you. Mr. Burkholz, you have the final word.
As a couple of key points to address, I think what's interesting is what we believe Judge Westfall did, and then what the law says somewhere in between. In fact, if you look at Judge Westfall's order, he actually, I think, is a very smart judge, and he knew that this wasn't a de facto change. He couldn't support his reasoning on that, so he goes to, and he didn't discuss, the appellant's addendum, page 43, June 7, 2018, Judge Westfall's order, page 3. In fact, his focus is on 518.175, and he bolds, if the modification would not change the child's primary residence. He's essentially created new law. And says, I'm going to apply the endangerment standard if I think that tail clause applies. That's what he did.
And I agree with you. There's no real cases that suggest that. I mean, the statute is pretty vague about about on that point.
And I agree. And he wanted that conclusion. And I think that's consistent. Everyone thinks they know what the judge thinks, but when you bring an alternative motion for Wednesday, and he says, I'm not going to change the benefit of the bargain, again, ignores the best interest factors.
Well, but in his amended order, I'm looking at page 62 of your addendum. Mm-hmm. I mean, he does say, okay, it isn't just the notion of honoring the party's bargain, but he does talk about the children's best interests and the disruption in the school year of having any change, even giving father an extra hour a day, and how that disrupts the homework and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, he did, in the amended order at least, he talk about best interests, as you suggest he should.
Yeah. He throws one sentence at it. He just quotes, from the court's perspective, it would be better to have that transfer occur earlier in time so the children would have a longer uninterrupted period during which they can do their schoolwork. Well, interestingly enough, his justification would support Mr. Jones's entire request in its entirety. And in essence, as it interrupts the schedule and then blames the parties for being quotes. What is really happening is that I think, and Mr. Jones's position is, if you look at the best interest, there's nothing to defend the ultimate best interest conclusion, which is, and it simply is this, the children thrive in the summer, they don't fight in the summer. If you read every affidavit, it's consistent. They don't fight in the summer. Every week on the golf, it's wonderful. You can look at all the Art Family Wizard fighting, it's in school year. Mr. Jones doesn't want to fight on a day-to-day transition when he picks up the kids, takes off work early, and fights about bringing them home for supper at 5:30, if not 5:35 or 6. That's the fight Mr. Jones was attempting to avoid, but the parties through the lawyer said, we can't help these people in mediation, so let's just throw this schedule at them and hope it sticks. And it didn't stick, unfortunately. It stuck for 2 years, probably because there was a statement that their loss is 2 years for a change of custody and all. Lawyers telling him not to come back right away because you made a bad deal.
Well, and part of it also is logistics just get more complicated as children age and have more activities. And
but they're great kids.
Right.
They're great kids and lots of activities if you read the affidavit. Mr. Jones gets the worst end of the deal now. The kids sit in all the activities. He makes sure that they're there. He gets them some food. He sits there, picks them up, and drives them back. And mom gets the wonderful time in the evening. Why is 2:30 to 5:30 less valuable than 5:30 to 8:30 every day? And in essence, that's the fundamental crux here, is that he has the time, he has the joint custody, and all we're doing is switching and reallocating time. This doesn't even have to be an issue about giving more or less time to the parties, because he already has it. But in essence, we've always gone back to the overnights, and we've been fighting that battle, and I'm going to continue to do it at the court, where all we're doing is fighting about overnights.
In looking at the stipulation, the original stipulation, it seems like the primary residence was focused on mailing address and for school purposes. So this wouldn't change the primary residence, but it...
No, he's never had that issue. Never once it changed. I think we'd even stipulate to give mom a few extra days if it made anybody feel better. This has never been the fight. We didn't ask to change custody. We didn't ask to change child support. We just wanted to reallocate the time because the kids thrive in that schedule of week on, week off, because it worked in the summer and it has not worked in the school year. And that's actually shown. And the judge shows they're quarrelsome when they fight when they're on this day-to-day alternating schedule. And we should adjust the schedule. And the judge just wouldn't look at it at any context. Wouldn't adjust 1 day, 2 days, every day. It just says, I'm going to leave it the way it is.
But given the deferential standard of review, even on looking, at the alternate request and the judge's discussion on page 62, what grounds is there to reverse that?
Well, if you have 12 factors and you don't address any of them, I can't imagine a court affirming with appropriate findings under the best interest factors. We would have to simply say that you don't have to specifically address anything as long as it provides some conclusion. I think there has to be some minimal level of deferential review. The court has repeatedly said, or this court, excuse me, Judge Westfall said, I'm not going to address the best interest factors. So it would be very hard to say that he intended to address them and he didn't intend to address them.
Although he did address them, not in at least a cursory, in your opinion, way, in the amended order, with respect to the request for parenting time less than alternating weeks.
I highly disagree. I don't need to repeat the entire paragraph, but he just simply likes to say, well, the first two or three paragraphs are about preserving the benefit of the bargain. The third paragraph says the court just has some concerns. That's the one paragraph, and it's only about one issue on the delay of time. So of all the things raised in the affidavits, about 8 pages, single space on both sides, we address one delay of 1 hour, and that's sufficient findings to support a denial of parenting time for teenagers. We're in trouble.
Any more questions? Okay, thank you both for your arguments. They were helpful, and your briefing as well. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.
Thank you.